This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. More than 60 years ago, Robert Moog revolutionized electronic music with the invention of the Moog synthesizer. It was one of the first widely used electronic instruments and has been featured in music by artists ranging from the Beatles and the Monkees to jazz pianist Herbie Hancock. But despite his immense career success, Bob Moog kept his professional and personal lives quite separate. In fact, it wasn't until his death that his daughter, Michelle Moog-Coussa, began to learn about the scope of his professional influence. For the past decade, she has devoted her time to building and running the Bob Moog Foundation, an Asheville-based nonprofit that celebrates her father's legacy through preservation and education. Michelle Moog-Coussa joins me now from partner station WCQS in Asheville. Michelle, welcome to State of Things.
Hi, Frank. It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
It's really good to have you. I'd like to learn more about you and your early days growing up. You were born in Tompkins County, New York, right?
I was. I was born in Ithaca, which is where my father was getting his PhD in engineering physics at Cornell University. So all of the Moog children were born there during that time.
Born there in Ithaca, and of course, that's an important feature. I mean, your dad was an engineer, and he will talk about that, endlessly, about the questions about whether he's a musician or an engineer. But I want to know more about growing up. So in those early years, you moved. You didn't stay there long, right? You moved from out of Ithaca and then eventually went to Buffalo, New York, right?
That's correct. I was born in 1968, and my father wound up selling his business in about 1971, and the owner of the business moved it to Williamsville, New York, right outside of Buffalo. So yes, we moved when I was just over 3 years old.
So, and we talked about this, the fact that he's an inventor and an engineer. When you were growing up in those first 3 years and then moving to Buffalo, because by then he'd had a business, what did you know about what he did and his creative style and just what it was he was engineering and making?
Well, I would say in the first 3 years, I don't have any memory of knowing what he did. It wasn't, I think there was a general knowledge around the house that Dad invented the synthesizer, but other than that, we weren't encouraged to explore that whole concept. But it wasn't until I was about 5 years old that my mother sat us all down one evening to watch To Tell the Truth. I don't know if you remember that game show.
Yes, of course. Yes. Will the Real.
Will the Real, exactly. And in my house, we weren't allowed to watch very much TV, so this was a rather momentous occasion that my mom would actually ask us to come watch TV, and it was because my dad was going to be on To Tell the Truth. And it was at that point, particularly at the very end, when they said, "Will the real Robert Moog please stand up?" And there's my dad, who, you know, I only thought of as, you know, this quiet, serious, you know, kind of dry-witted, rare-presenced guy. All of a sudden, I had to reckon with the fact that he was something very different to the rest of the world.
There he was, sitting in front of Kitty Carlisle and Orson Bean, for God's sake, and answering questions. And so the show is a panel of kind of New York smart people, you know, like Kitty Carlisle and Orson Bean, who had been around this New York City circuit, right? And they would ask, so they're celebrities, and they would ask questions of a panel of three people, each pretending to be this individual, and then you'd get a brief dossier, you'd get a bit of a CV, who these people were, what they did, and then you pummeled each of them with questions to figure out who really was Robert Moog. Of course, America is really kind of at this point finding out about this instrument and what it meant. And maybe we should do that right now for those who don't know and weren't there at the beginning. I think probably it's safe to say that while it wasn't the first time the Moog synthesizer was used in recorded music, probably Wendy Carlos Switched on Bach was the record that brought the Moog synthesizer to our attention. And it sounded like this.
Thank you.
clip from Wendy Carlos switched on Bach featuring the Moog synthesizer invented by Robert Moog. I'm talking today with his daughter, Michelle Moog-Kusa, the executive director of the Asheville-based Bob Moog Foundation. That kind of there was synthesized music, and there were forms of synthesizers, mostly in the form of a theremin, that had been used before this. But as I understand it, your dad's real innovation here was to use transistors in the process, and that made it a much more usable and practical instrument. Am I right?
Yes, I'd say to a first approximation, that is part of what he did. But what he also did is made the synthesizer. There were other synthesizers that came before the Moog synthesizer, but many of them filled up. They were more computer-based and filled up whole rooms, and they were interfaced by paper feeds, and you had to program in one note at a time. So what Bob Moog did was made the synthesizer accessible to musicians. And he did that by making them smaller, but also creating a whole vocabulary around the functionality of the synthesizer and, of course, developing some functionality that didn't exist prior.
Right. So in a sense, you could play a keyboard, and while you could create different sounds that weren't necessarily a piano or an organ, you could play an instrument that to a musician was a familiar instrument as a way of getting the sound into the synthesizer.
Well, as a way of accessing the sound, yes. Bob Moog made a very deliberate choice, and it was a choice, to attach a keyboard to the synthesizer. There were certain schools of thought that that shouldn't be done because electronic music should be approached in a way that wasn't quite as conventional. Hmm. But his interest was really to provide a wide sonic palette, a new sonic palette to musicians. And since musicians were most familiar with the keyboard, he did decide to use that as the interface. And it's through the keyboard then they could access, you know, all the sounds that were available in the circuitry.
And it caught on with musicians right away. I mean, we talked about Switched on Bach. That came out in 68, but musicians were already using it, not in such a high profile as Switched on Bach, but the Doors and the Monkees were already using it in their music at least a year before this, right?
The Doors, the Monkees, yes, that's right.
Yeah. So it was in there, and then again, Switched on Bach is that's sort of on the album cover. That's part of the publicity around it. So this is a big deal, and yet, while your dad was a remarkable engineer that transformed music, the business world was not necessarily in his skill set. Am I right?
It was not his forte. He was really a creative innovator, and his interest was in expanding the sonic landscape, and the bottom line was kind of a secondary concern.
Right. So, and part of that concern was the move to Buffalo. Tell us what was behind that, and you know why the family moved to Buffalo.
Well, after Switched on Bach came out, there was quite a boom in the sale of Moog modular synthesizers, which are the bigger, older, vintage synthesizers. And that lasted for about a year. And then people began to discover how difficult they were to use. That, in combination with a recession on Madison Avenue, and it was Madison Avenue who were purchasing a lot of the modular synthesizers for commercials and such. The combination of those two things led to a complete drop in sales of the modulars, and R.A. Moog Co., which was the name of the company at the time, found themselves in a place of financial peril. And by 1970, my father was $250,000 in debt. Mm. And that number has been mentioned many times in my family and in my work. And I finally, just this year, decided to see exactly how much that would be today. And it would be about, adjusted for inflation, $1.5 million.
Wow. Yeah. But this is a thing that everybody likes. It's revolutionizing it, but hard to capitalize for a variety of reasons. Tell us about the transition for you. I mean, I understand that for business reasons, you know, your dad takes the family there. What was it like for you to uproot and move?
Well, again, I was only three, But we did live in a very idyllic setting in right outside of Ithaca in Trumansburg. We lived in a farmhouse with a big barn on the property on 55 acres of land, with a huge stream across the street where we would go wading and swimming during the warm months. And we had an acre pond on the land, and Trumansburg was a very small town, I think at that time, of 1,200 people. Very beautiful. That whole area in upstate New York is very beautiful. And then we moved to Williamsville, New York, which is a modest suburb outside of Buffalo. So it was quite a change from our way of life in Trumansburg. But my mother, you know, remained at home taking care of all of us, and my father, you know, remained outside the home working. So those two things were constants. But although the stress of not being in debt was lifted, he began to go through, you know, other stressors of now working for a company that bore his name but was no longer his own.
We'll talk more about that and how being the daughter of Bob Moog doesn't necessarily make you a great piano player unless he comes up with a plan to help you learn how to play. Michelle Moog-Cusa is my guest, executive director of the Bob Moog Foundation, which is in Asheville. It's a nonprofit preserving the legacy of Bob Moog. And our conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and I'm talking with Michelle Moog-Cusa. She's the daughter of electronic music hero Robert Moog, the inventor of the Moog synthesizer. For the past decade, she has run the Bob Moog Foundation, which is based in Asheville. It's a nonprofit preserving his legacy. Michelle, tell us about, I understand that you had some trouble playing the piano as a young girl, and your dad figured out a way, kind of what was going on and how to help you with that. Tell us that story.
He did. I took piano lessons when I was about 5 years old, and I initially enjoyed it, but I quickly began to have some issues when it came to actually playing songs and reading notes. And I got very frustrated because of that, as you might imagine. And I confided in my younger brother, who was maybe just 3 or 4 at the time, that I wanted to quit because I just wasn't getting it. And he wound up announcing that to the family that night at dinner, much to my chagrin.
He snitched.
But that's okay, Matt. No problem. But I was very upset about that. But what that led to was my father realizing how frustrated I was, and it made him pause and wonder why. I think he knew that I liked music in general, and I was kind of innately musical in the sense that I sang along with songs and such. And so he sat down with me and had me play for him, and I was kind of horrified because, you know, you want to do well for your parents. But I think he said to me, hold on a minute, and he went to his office and he got a legal-sized yellow pad and came back, and he drew the notes that I was trying to play about 10 times bigger than they appeared on the page. And then he asked me to play it, and I played it perfectly. And I remember him calling into my mother in the kitchen, which was right next to the piano, and saying, surely I think Michelle has a vision problem. And unfortunately, by that time, my little 5-year-old mind was already made up, and I decided I wasn't going to play. But it did turn out that I had amblyopia, which is when you have one eye that's much weaker than the other. And that eventually corrected itself. But it was a very revealing moment to me as a child of my father's perception and his approach, even as a scientist, because in its own way, there's a problem to be solved. And he had his theory about it, and he tested it, and he wound up being right. So I certainly appreciated the fact that my inability to play was not just dismissed as any other maybe not so positive characteristics that one could think of, but rather that he was trying to get to the real root of the problem.
Well, it's fascinating that you wouldn't, dismiss that as a 5-year-old not wanting to play, not wanting to practice anymore, or just maybe not being very good. I mean, there's 1,000 ways a good dad and a good engineer could dismiss that. So to break it down into particles and say, well, what part is she getting and what part isn't she based on your playing? pretty cool. Did he do a lot of that stuff around the house? I mean, you know, was he sort of looking at better ways to open the door and walk down the stairs, that sort of thing?
When those opportunities arose, absolutely. There was definitely an engineering aspect to almost everything he did, even to he loved to cook, which was also, as he would say, a form of synthesis. And even the way he approached cooking in this very precise manner. And at one point, he and my mother designed a house together, and you could see the kind of engineering intention that went on to that. And even just in, you know, small household repairs or, you know, redesigning a room or, you know, whatever it may be, there was a certain amount of very insightful precision into his kind of thought process.
Well, your family eventually did move to North Carolina. What precipitated that move?
My father met a gentleman named George Kalachek at a NAMM show in California.
And
I'm sorry, the National Association of Music Merchants. It's a show that these days is held in Anaheim, California. Every year, where over 1,500 music merchants come together to show their new wares, and over 100,000 people come and see what's being produced by the music instrument industry. And my father was there in a small booth, and this man, George Kalachek, was as well. And George is a wood instrument manufacturer based in Brasstown, North Carolina. And he invited my father to come visit him. And my father and mother just fell in love with this area. And that's what eventually brought us down here. That just happened to be a couple years before my parents thought that they might be leaving Moog Music, the company up in Buffalo. So the timing was kind of fortuitous. Well, they did wind up buying a couple pieces of property, not in Asheville, but about 20 miles outside of Asheville in two little towns called Lester and Sandy Mush, and they wound up building a house on one of those properties.
Well, this does lead to the question that whether or not your father considered himself a musician or an engineer. I mean, how deep was his interest in music for itself?
Well, I think he had a very deep interest in music, right down to the scientific level. However, when you would ask him, if you were to pose the question to him, are you a musician? He would say, I'm not a musician, despite the fact that he played the piano for 14 years. I'm not a musician. I'm a tool maker. I make tools for musicians. Right.
Yeah.
You know, and when he would say he played the piano, but that's different than being a musician. So he had a very keen awareness of the talent and aptitude and maybe even an X factor that was needed to be a musician. And he didn't feel that he quite had all of that.
Yeah, but he had the sort of zen-like ability to feel what the musician was feeling in the same way he got what you weren't getting about reading music, even though he's not a 3-year-old or 5-year-old girl or a musician. He gets what they're going through when he puts his mind to it.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, one of the things that he was known for was his ability to listen, not only his ability, but his interest in really listening, hearing what the musicians needed, wanted, and then providing the tools for them to be able to create, you know, that very transcendental language of music.
He worked on a lot of different things, including a career as a magazine writer. Tell us about his writing career.
In 1975, a magazine called Contemporary Keyboard was published, and my father began writing columns for them called On Synthesizers, and he would write about all different kinds of kind of technical, in-depth, very well-written issues about synthesis. Since it was a bit of a new field, a lot of people wound up learning a lot from him based, and of course his writings were based on everything he knew at that point from 20 years of experience, 30 years of experience at that point, yeah.
But again, we get back to this organization as an engineer, as a problem solver, as a designer, brilliant, as a guy who could meet deadlines and understand the business world not so good. You have a great story about meeting a deadline for him, one of his magazine deadlines, right?
Yes, I do. My father was a very good writer and, of course, knew his field very, very well. And those two things put together with the fact that he was a bit of a procrastinator led to the fact that he would often write his keyboard magazine articles in a day. And he would wait until the last day and write them, and then he would zoom into town, which was 17 or 20 miles away, and send them off overnight. And we always kind of knew this was going on because there was some sense, a low-grade sense of panic around the house. And there was a summer when I was learning to drive when I was 16. And everyone in our family learned how to drive on a stick shift. And I had a few issues at one point getting, you know, being able to start on hills without drifting back and such. And so the driving lessons were a little protracted for that reason. But I finally caught on and was zipping around town. And my dad was teaching me to drive, so he was the one I was driving with. And one day I was home with him during the summer, and I knew it was one of those keyboard magazine days where he was going to have his article at FedEx at 7, and he was in his shop, which was across the driveway from our house, furiously writing, and I was, you know, everyone else was just trying to stay away and let him get his work done. And he came downstairs to me at about 6:25 and said, "You want to drive me to FedEx?" And I, just for a minute, I absolutely froze and thought, I can't do that. If I don't get there fast enough, he's going to miss his deadline. And I knew that was a big deal. And, but then, you know, after about 5 seconds, I thought, well, you know what? If Dad thinks I can do it, I'm going to try. So we jumped in the car and I drove faster probably than I should have, but I think Dad knew I could do that at that point. We pulled into FedEx, which was 17 miles away down country roads and all of that, and out into town at 5:07. And he ran into FedEx, mailed the package, jumped in the car at right about 7 o'clock. He just looked at me, shut the door, looked at me and said, "We can go get your license tomorrow."
Passed the test. That's great. Plus, you've had a NASCAR moment in the mountains of North Carolina, so that's kind of cool too for you, I guess.
Yes.
Driving all that way, and it was. So, but now talk about that, because you said so. We knew to kind of stay away. I mean, was he a little bit temperamental? Did you have to sort of? Did he have moods? And when he was, especially when he was creating it, did you have to learn to steer clear?
It was less moods. I mean, yes, he did have moods, but it was more when he was working, he was extremely focused and extremely serious, and he didn't particularly want to be bothered. I mean, we would all go out at night and say goodnight to him. I would always go out and, you know, give him a kiss goodnight because he would work late into the evenings. And that would be one of the few times during the day that I would actually see him was when I went to give him a kiss goodnight. And he was always receptive, but you knew that it was a short-lived thing. I think people have this ideal of me climbing up in my dad's lap and, you know, us soldering together or something, but that's not the way it was. And you can imagine that, you know, his work was, he was very serious about his work. At any given juncture, he was, you know, forging these pathways that hadn't been forged before. And he was an extremely focused, committed, dedicated man. So it was more that I was referring to, you know, he needed his workspace, and we afforded him that.
Now, by the age of six, you talked about that moment on To Tell the Truth, you realized he was a big deal. But again, much of what you learned about the scope of his work, I understand, happened only after he died in terms of your understanding of the full impact. So now you're 16. What did you think it was he was doing? You knew he was busy. He was making stuff. What did you think it was all about?
Well, I knew he had a big impact on the world of music. And quite frankly, part of the reason I understood some of the impact is because at that point I had been through many years of school. And actually, when I went to ninth grade at Irwin High School, and I was taking physical science, which was one of my favorite classes. And one day we were leafing through our physical science textbook, and there was a picture of my father. And I remember someone saying, "There's Mimi's daddy." The Mimi was my nickname back then. And I just sat there and stared at my father's face, staring back at me. And I just, it's one of those kind of out-of-body surreal experiences where I had to kind of figure out how to you know, where the Venn diagram was between Dad and Bob Moog. So I did understand that he had had a big impact, that he was, quote unquote, famous, that he was renowned not only for his inventions, but for his innovative mind. And so there was that kind of basic understanding. As far as really understanding the changes that developed in music because of the instruments and other changes like that, I did not have very much awareness. And as far as understanding the true impact of his work on individual people, I had no understanding of that until he passed away.
Well, you talk about being close, certainly, to your father that whole time, and eventually got your driver's license, and that led you to leave the area and develop an interest in politics. Tell us how that developed.
Well, in between, we did leave North Carolina for just a few years. Not that my parents wanted to, because they absolutely loved this area. But once again, in 1984, my father was running low on funds and had four children he needed to put through college. So he wound up taking a job with a highly reputable synthesizer company called Kurzweil. And we moved up to Massachusetts at that time, right outside of Boston. And I was about 16 and a half when we moved. And it is there that I began working for our local congressman, Chet Atkins, and developed an interest in politics. I already kind of, you know, had an interest in history and English, and I started working with Chet, and then decided I wanted to major in political science and went off to George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and studied political science and had an absolute ball while I was there. It's just an incredible place to study politics, as you might imagine. And while I was there, I had the opportunity to intern for Barney Frank, who was another Massachusetts congressman. And there's probably no denying my political leanings at this point for everyone who's listening. But I learned a lot from that experience. I interned for one summer on the Hill. I also worked for the Office of the Corporation Counsel, which is the district attorney for Washington, D.C. And I studied political science and for 4 years, and my plan was to become an attorney, and my life kind of went in a different direction.
It went in the direction of Senegal. Tell us what happened. Tell us about that decision. What happened when you, after college, moved to Senegal?
My older sister Renee, who's 5 years older than I am, was in the Peace Corps in Senegal, West Africa. And I went to visit her with my parents and was introduced to her boyfriend's best friend named Joseph. And Joseph and I corresponded for a little bit, and then I wound up going back to visit a couple years later, and just to visit Renee, and wound up spending a lot of time with Joseph and Renee's boyfriend. And eventually fell in love with Joseph, and we are about to celebrate our 23rd wedding anniversary next month.
Congratulations.
So, thank you. We lived there for 4.5 years.
Eventually, though, you did move. And in fact, did you come right back to North Carolina when you left Senegal?
We did. We came right back to Asheville. I really wanted to be close to my parents. They were then divorced, but I really wanted to be close to both of them.
And you and your husband were working for your father at that time, right, when you came back?
We were. My father had a lot of his materials out in the shop across from where in the childhood home where I grew up, and he wasn't living there anymore. So we lived there, and we were kind of helping him sort out some of his archives and beginning to digitize them. This, of course, is in 1997, so all of that is a little bit on the new side. As far as the technology and all of that.
Go ahead. He was working for a new company called Big Briar at that time, right? Can you tell us what
yes.
he was working on?
Sure. He actually started Big Briar prior to 1980, just after moving here. And it was through Big Briar that he was developing custom musical instruments and some unusual interfaces in the early 80s. And that then didn't go quite as well as he would have liked financially, and then we moved to Boston. And when he came back, let's see, that would have been in 1988, he revamped Big Briar, and he began building theremins, which was always his first love. And by the time we came back from Senegal 10 years later, he was doing quite well with selling theremins. And just to clue your readers in, theremins are very early electronic musical instruments that were invented not by Bob Moog, but by Leon Theremin, who was a Russian physicist. And they're quite magical in that you play them without touching them. And for anyone who's interested, I'd encourage them to get online and read all about them. But the both elegant and expressive design of the theremin really inspired my father his whole life. So he continued to make several iterations of theremins, and by the late 90s, he also started making a line of what's known as Moogerfogers, which are effect pedals. They're essentially different modules, different parts of synthesis in a interface that's playable for guitar players and synthesists.
I'm talking to Michelle Moog-Coussa, the executive director of the Bob Moog Foundation. It's a nonprofit based in Asheville that preserves the archives and legacy of Robert Moog, the inventor of the Moog synthesizer. More about her life and her relationship with her father and Bob Moog's influence on music, all of that just ahead on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest is Michelle Moog-Coussa. She's executive director of the Bob Moog Foundation, a nonprofit in Asheville that preserves the legacy of Robert Moog, who invented the Moog synthesizer. Michelle, you talked about going back to Asheville, working with your father for a bit, but tell us about your personal life. That time, you had the children. You opened a boutique in Asheville, too, right?
I did. When we returned from Senegal, my son Gregory was 2 years old, and one of the reasons we went to Senegal is because we knew it would be easy to save a lot of money, and we wanted to do that and start our own business. And so we did that. We started a gift boutique in downtown Asheville called Amore, which I had for over 8 years. And during that time, just a year and a half after I opened the store, my daughter Yasmin was born. She's now 16. So, yes, I had a couple of kids and was running a gift boutique.
And were you thinking about, because you spent some of that time kind of getting things together with your father, had you imagined yourself sort of working together, or was that just something you did? I mean, you imagined yourself rather going off on your own, starting your boutique. I wonder how you thought about your life and whether or not you figured it would be entwined with your father's work.
I did not. You know, it never had been, and I didn't foresee that happening. I also didn't foresee that I had the technical knowledge that was needed, and I did have an aspiration to have my own business, and so did my husband. So that did seem to be the course that we were taking at that time.
I wonder about that, because that, you know, your father's genius, certainly with music and engineering, is unquestioned. And you talked about a couple of times when he ran short of cash and ran into these business problems. Did that scare you? Did you think, well, what am I doing getting into business? In terms of your own ability as a business person, yeah.
Right. I did not think of it quite that way, because my husband is he's a controller. He's a bookkeeper, controller in the accounting sense of the word. Right. He has a very good sense for business. And I knew that working with him, that we would be able to, you know, kind of keep on the straight and narrow as far as the bottom line went. And, you know, I also learned some lessons from kind of watching my father. And of course, our businesses were very, very very different, yes.
So in 2005, I understand your father began having some troubles that came on pretty quickly. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I can. In April of 2005, he was having some issues with his left hand and his left arm, and he was doing things like whatever he was typing wasn't coming out right, and he had some weird sensations in his arm, and he was seeing some alternative medical providers, chiropractors and such, body workers, about it. And they were convinced that he had a pinched nerve of some sort. He should probably go see a traditional his regular GP. Mm-hmm. But he first had to go to a trip to Alaska and California for business. And during that time, the issue became worse, and he began to lose the use of his left arm. Mm-hmm. When he returned, I had lunch with him, something we would do every other week together. And he was seated by the time I joined him. But at the end of the lunch, he did tell me that he had a health issue, which really took me aback because my father was a very strong man and hardly ever had any health issues other than allergies that I could remember. And he told me that he was having these issues and it was affecting his arm and that he was going to see our family doctor. But when he stood up, he was not able to put his arm back in his jacket sleeve by himself. It's something I had to assist him with. And I was quite taken aback. I didn't realize that things had degraded to that extent. So he called me. He did go, and he had a CAT scan done, which showed nothing. And then he had to wait a week to get an MRI. He got the results of the MRI on April 28th of 2005, and he called me on April 29th. I will never forget that day because I was sitting in my store, and it was kind of empty. And he called, and he announced to me that he had the results of the MRI, and he didn't have a pinched nerve. And I said, "Oh, well, what do you have?" And he said, "I have a brain tumor." Just like that. Hmm. And it was at that moment that I fully understood in a very visceral way what the phrase, "you could have knocked me over with a feather," meant. Hmm. And I knew, I knew at that moment that everything was about to shift in one way or another. And he did, he fought the brain tumor for 3 months and 3 weeks, but he did succumb to it on August 21st of 2005. Mm.
In the meantime, your brother had set up, your brother had set up a CareBridge page for your dad, for the family, to kind of keep everybody posted. Is that right?
It was my brother Matthew who set up a page on the caringbridge.com, mm-hmm. which is a wonderful website where people who are critically or terminally ill can keep in touch with their family and friends without people calling and, interrupting sleep schedules and such. It allows them to communicate and interface with people they love, but on their own schedule. My father asked my brother to find some kind of way that he could keep up with 40 people that he really cared about. They were both family and friends. And he would be updating that site, and people could, send him little messages as well. And my brother sent out the link and to that page, and one person did not understand that this was supposed to be very discreet because we didn't want my father's illness to get out into the press, and we were trying to protect his privacy. And someone posted the link on a synthesizer chat group, and there were 1,000 hits on the site in a day. And my brother got a little upset because here again, we're trying to protect my father's privacy. He put up a password and sent the password out. And then about 2 days later, my father surprised us all. And he said to Matthew, "You know what? Just let him come. Take the password down. Just let him come." And in the first 7 weeks, there were 60,000 hits on that CaringBridge page. And the day my father died, 20,000 people logged onto that page. And what's more stunning, I think, than those numbers is the fact that over 3,500 people from 67 countries left testimonials about how Bob Moog had not only changed, but transformed their lives. With notes like, "Bob Moog gave me my creative voice. Because of Bob Moog, I'm a musician. Because of Bob Moog, I'm an engineer. Bob Moog is the inspiration for everything I do," and on and on. And I think it was at that point that there was a major dawning for myself and my entire family about the true inspirational impact on a very human level that my father had on people all over the world. And that was quite a revelation for us. For me, I describe it as the wall that my father had kind of either wittingly or unwittingly put up our whole lives around his work suddenly came crashing down. And I was blinded by the the outpouring, the enlightenment of who Bob Moog really was and what he meant to people.
Not only around his work, but it seems to me around his fame as well. You said it was surprising to you when your father asked your brother to take down the password. Certainly no surprise that there would be this outpouring. Surprising that he took down the password. He didn't necessarily take praise well, did he? And he didn't. It was something that he didn't talk about, as I understand it.
He did not. He was very humble, and I think there were a lot of reasons for that. One of which is that he was often credited with "quote unquote" inventing the synthesizer. He knew that that was not true. His work was built on the shoulders of many giants. He studied and lectured about those giants. There are also his contemporaries who were also building synthesizers of other kinds at that time. So I think that made him deprecating about, yeah. You know, what his role is. Also, I think that he knew intellectually, mentally, even spiritually, that once you begin to think of yourself as somehow superior to other people, that you cross a line within yourself that you can never go back. And he was very disciplined about not going there. And he did not embrace the notion of celebrity. He didn't like being treated like one. He didn't really like the attention. So.
Were you ever with him at a time when, you know, acolytes and others who just felt devoted and devotees would walk up to him and start gushing? What was that like? And had you ever seen anything like that with him?
I did. Really, there was just one time, we're going back to the NAMM show now, but in a much different year, when in my senior year of college, my father suggested that I join him at the NAMM show out in California in January, and then we would drive up to see my paternal grandparents who lived in Santa Barbara. So I flew out and met him, and it was really one of the very, very few work things I can ever remember doing with him, and certainly the biggest one. NAMM is quite an impressive convention. And as we were walking in the show, this middle-aged man who looked a little bit like Howard Stern, you know, kind of your stereotypical tall, thin, long-haired musician type, comes up to my dad and said, "Oh my God, are you Bob Moog?" And my dad, you could tell my dad's body language completely changed, you know, immediately. And he kind of, you know, he said yes. And the guy dropped to his knees and basically started bowing to my dad and saying, you know, you're my inspiration. You're my idol. You know, everything I do is because of your inventions. And he was just going on and on. And at that point, I think my mind just kind of went blank because I personally was just walking the show with my dad, and then all of a sudden, this guy, Bob Moog, this big presence kind of rears its head. And once again, as I did when I was 5 years old, I was trying in that moment to merge these two entities, and it was very difficult. And my dad's there, you know, he's kind of the, you know, geeky type, and his hands were in his pockets, and he was shifting his weight around, and he was looking down at the floor, and he's, you know, kind of had a grimace on his face. And the guy finally stood up and, like, grabbed my dad's hand and shook it and said, "Well, thank you so much," and he walked away. And, you know, my dad just said, well, I'll paraphrase here, he said, "God, that guy was a jerk." And you know, I don't think he really meant that. The guy wasn't a jerk. I think what he really meant is that, you know, it was very hard for him to be on the receiving end of that much kind of adulation. He just really saw himself as, you know, an engineer, as a tool maker, as, you know, as the same importance as someone who makes great hammers for carpenters. It's, you know, someone who makes great drums. He saw his role very differently than other people saw his role.
And he certainly did have a transformative effect on the musical landscape. Again, we talked about the ways in which the Moog was embedded in songs that you might not have even noticed, the Monkees, the Doors, other artists.
In
the Beatles, not to mention the Beatles. That's pop music. It was in jazz classical as well. But then there's groups like Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Keith Emerson, who recently passed away. I mean, just to give you a sense of how they saw this instrument as something that could actually transform the landscape, just a little clip here from Emerson, Lake and Palmer, "Lucky Man." Let's listen.
Ooh, what a lucky man he was.
That's a clip from Emerson, Lake & Palmer, the song Lucky Man, featuring the Moog synthesizer. And I'm talking with Michelle Moog-Kusa, who is head of the foundation that tries to recollect and keep the memory of Bob Moog alive and advance it as well. You actually wrote a blog piece recently after Keith Emerson passed away earlier this year about his importance to the music as well, haven't you?
I did. Keith Emerson was a friend of mine that I was fortunate enough to make, of course, through my dad's connection to him. And he was a very good friend of my father's. And yes, he had an enormous impact on the evolution of the use of the Moog synthesizer, the way he chose to use it. I mean, he basically pioneered the use of these enormous Moog modular synthesizer in a live rock context, which is something nobody had done before. He toured with this instrument that was notoriously, you know, a bit difficult to use, a bit difficult to keep in tune, very expensive, hard to set up. But he was committed to the expressive nature of the instrument and the way that it gave him voices that he would have otherwise not had. And he really used that to enormous effect. And after Wendy Carlos, he's probably the person who helped bring the Moog synthesizer to the forefront.
Well, and it's still going today. And I think part of your foundation's work is to show the infinite possibilities. And you've got the creation of Dr. Bob's Sound School, for instance. Tell us about that work.
Dr. Bob's Sound School is our hallmark educational project, and this is really where we feel Bob Moog's legacy comes alive through our work. We teach little kids in Western North Carolina about the science of sound through music and technology. We've created a 10-week curriculum that meets state and national standards, so it's taught by the second grade teachers, but it's highly interactive and experiential, and it gets kids to think about sound and science through the mediums of discovery and exploration. And it's multidisciplinary and multisensory. So we're really aiming to engage children in science and to do it in a way that really sticks with them so that they think of science as something that's fun and valuable.
And carries with them in their own creative lives. Well, I know you're doing that and a lot more at the Bob Moog Foundation. And we have links to your foundation at our website, stateofthings.org, to find out all that you're doing, Michelle Moog-Kusa. But for now, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you, Frank. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
Michelle Moog-Kusa, the executive director of the Bob Moog Foundation. It's a nonprofit that carries forward the legacy of Moog synthesizer and its inventor, Robert Moog. You can learn more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brett Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.